Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Extraordinary meetings underway today in China. A third of the U.S. cabinet, led by Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, plus Fed Chief Ben Bernanke and the head of the EPA, all in Beijing. An unprecedented rollout of American officials urgently seeking economic reform and favors from China. The so-called U.S.-China Strategic Economic Dialogue is partly to kowtow to China's soaring global economic clout and partly to cajole Beijing into changes Washington is desperate to see. At stake, jobs, interest rates, prices at Walmart and everywhere else, and maybe the global economy. The finance men fear a Chinese meltdown, a U.S. meltdown, or maybe both, and more. Up next on Point, American power goes to China. We'll talk in a moment with a former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund and with the chief economist at the investment bank Morgan Stanley. But first, joining me from Beijing is Krishna Guha, who's covering the big economic summit for the Financial Times. Krishna Guha, thanks for being with us there. The Chinese beginning by making the noises that Washington wants to hear?
Well, the Chinese are making it quite clear that they are going to continue opening up their economy, continue liberalizing, but they're going to do it at their own pace. And they've been careful today to resist any suggestion that they might be speeding things up because they're under pressure from Washington. Wu Yi, who's the Chinese, one of the Chinese vice premiers with responsibility for the economic portfolio, was very clear in her remarks today that China was, in a sense, pursuing the course that it had laid out, an ongoing program of reforms, but one that wasn't going to be particularly influenced, perhaps, by pressure from Washington.
There's a whole new world. Krishna Guha, remind us of who is part of this extraordinary delegation of American top dogs that's there in Beijing now. Who's included?
Well, it's a who's who of the economic policymaking team in the U.S. You have Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, Commerce Secretary Gutierrez, Labor Secretary Elaine Chao, Health and Human Services Secretary Mike Leavitt. You've got Energy Secretary Sam Bodman, the U.S. Trade Rep, Susan Schwab, the EPA Administrator, Steve Johnson, and by the way, they've also brought Ben Bernanke, the Fed Chairman.
No less than that. Is there any precedent for this scale of top gun raft of officials heading to China on such a mission?
You know, the officials I've spoken to today say that really it's impossible to find any precedent for a delegation this senior and this broad. Mr. Gutierrez said to me earlier on today that this is really almost a cabinet-to-cabinet meeting. The entire economic cabinet officials of the U.S. meeting their counterparts in China. That's something that's never really happened, certainly in the U.S.-China relationship. It's not obvious it's really happened in any other U.S. economic relationship either.
A powerful indicator of just how high the stakes are and of China's power in attracting a delegation of that scale and that kind of altitude. What is it that the United States wants and needs to come out of these talks and this relationship?
Well, what the U.S. needs in the long run is for China to shift its growth model, to start to rely more on domestic consumption to fuel its economy rather than simply exports to the rest of the world, and in particular to the U.S. It wants China to open its domestic markets and remove obstacles for U.S. companies, not just manufacturers, but also financial services companies, for instance. Mr. Paulson, an ex-Goldman Sachs CEO, is very keen to promote the opening of the financial services sector. And the U.S. also wants cooperation from China on issues like energy and increasingly the environment, too, where, if you think about it, the US and China are the two most important consumers of energy, consumers of oil, if they can cooperate rather than try to lock up energy supplies, this will benefit both countries.
There's been a lot of talk about currencies. The dollar, of course, weaker recently. The Chinese currency up a little, but it's tightly controlled. Has Hank Paulson come with a target, with a demand or a request about where he wants that to be, what, in order to maybe dampen some American imports from China and encourage American exports?
Well, Mr. Paulson has been very diplomatic on the currency issue. He's had to walk a careful line because he believes, probably correctly, that if he simply lectures the Chinese, they'll refuse point blank to do anything that he wants. On the other hand, of course, if he goes too soft in his language on the Chinese, U.S. business starts to complain, and we already saw pressure from the manufacturers before he left for him to get tough in Beijing. So what he is trying to tell the Chinese is that it would be in their own interest to allow the currency, their currency, the renminbi, to appreciate more rapidly, that it would help deal with inflationary pressures, help rebalance the economy, help them develop an independent monetary policy that would allow more effective management of their economy. So he's trying to persuade them to do it not for the benefit of the U.S., but for their own benefit. And what he's saying is, look, I understand that in order to get to a fully flexible currency, it's going to take time, it's going to need reform in the financial sector, but that should be China's intermediate goal. And in the meanwhile, he's asking China to show more flexibility on a day-to-day basis with the currency.
Meanwhile, the U.S. trade deficit with China yawning bigger and bigger, China holding, what, $339 billion now in U.S. debt, and pressure at home because of job losses, factories closing down, the sense of jobs going abroad. Congress already, Charles Schumer, a Democrat, and Lindsey Graham, Republican, have threatened this year protectionist measures. Is Hank Paulson trying to head those off by getting some kind of concessions from China? Can he get what he needs from Beijing right now?
Well, I think the pressure on him to deliver right now is perhaps not as intense as it looked as if it might be earlier on in the year. The strange thing about congressional pressure on China is it does seem to ebb and flow. Sometimes Congress is really riled about China. Other times it has other issues on its plate. Paulson has always said that the U.S. needs to start dealing with China in much more of a long-term and strategic vein rather than simply squabbling over the latest dispute, whether it be a currency-related one or a trade-related dispute. Nonetheless, he's mindful of the fact that the patience back home is not limitless, and that he needs to start delivering some down payments to show that his approach, his cooperative approach, is actually going to bring some results. So he is aware that the time is not unlimited, even though he believes he has a little bit of space for maneuver at the moment.
We're going to talk in this hour about the very high stakes behind these talks. Krishna Guha, U.S. economics correspondent for the Financial Times in Beijing, thank you very much for being with us.
My great pleasure.
We're looking this hour at what Washington wants and needs from China as the Chinese economy soars and U.S. debt mounts. Joining me now from New York is Kenneth Rogoff. He's professor of economics at Harvard University. He was chief economist at the International Monetary Fund from 2001 to 2003. He's currently a visiting fellow of global economy and development at the Brookings Institution. Kenneth Rogoff, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure to be here.
So take us in here. We've got a gang like never before seen in Beijing from Washington, the entire economic wing and more of the U.S. cabinet. Why such a high-profile visit? What are the stakes in this visit?
Well, this is a dialogue that's been going on for a long time, but it's been moving very slowly. And on the American side, there's a lot of dissatisfaction with the speed at which China's moving. There's a feeling that we've opened up to you. We let you join the World Trade Organization. You're able to export your textiles without limit. You're able to export goods anywhere you want. But we can't get in. You're not respecting our intellectual property rights. You have a too nationalistic an economic policy. And there's a big protectionist pressure growing in Congress, in the public. And I think it's true that it goes and ebbs and flows. But right now, it's the Democratic Party, I think, in particular, has seized on growing income inequality from globalization as a big thing. So there's a lot of pressure to deliver something.
Pressure on protectionism, but as you would know well, having been chief economist at the International Monetary Fund, but also concern about China's economy itself, the possibility for it to sort of crash with global ramifications there. What's the risk there? Never mind how high it is exactly right now, but to the extent that there is such a risk, what's the structure that presents it?
Well, it's an emerging market. It's developing politically, socially, economically, and stuff happens. You don't just have smooth growth. We have hundreds of years of history with this, and it's likely that there'll be a problem at some point. I don't think that's the immediate concern, but the truth is this currency flexibility, which seems like this really technical, esoteric issue, we have learned over time often lies at the heart of international financial crises. Right now, everything in China is great. The economy is growing strong. Mm. Everyone wants to be there, but the tables can turn.
So if China strengthens its currency, if the dollar falls in relationship to it, even though Paulson says he's for a strong dollar, does that really change things? Does it really help things? The renminbi has been creeping up. How much would it have to move, and does it really matter if it does?
Well, I mean, I think there are two separate points. One is to make it flexible, so that if there's a crisis, it can go down instead of having the whole economy go with it. We've learned that. But there's a separate point that many people feel that China has low wages, that it's hyper-competitive, and they ought to do something to mitigate that. And the truth of the matter is a small currency movement like they're talking about is not going to matter that much. But it's definitely going to throw Congress a bone. It's become a big rallying point for those who want China to have a less nationalistic policy. And that, I think, is the biggest reason that they're under pressure to do something.
Mm. We're talking this hour about America's top money men seeking relief in Beijing, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, Fed Chief Ben Bernanke, plus a raft of cabinet members in China now for an extraordinary meeting with leaders of the world's hottest economy. Are they kowtowing, cajoling? No matter what you call it, it's a high-profile demonstration of shifting power dynamics and economic needs and fears. A little clip here from Chinese television news this week as Home Depot announced it's purchasing 12 home improvement stores in China.
The Home Depot 通过增加服务来拓展业务，在家居服务部门。
Working hard to link up with this economy, Walmart's got 60 plus. There's a whole lot more American investment there. But what does the road look like ahead? We've been joined by Kenneth Rogoff. He's professor of economics at Harvard University, was chief economist at the International Monetary Fund until 2003. We're joined now also from New York by Stephen Roach. He's managing director and chief economist at Morgan Stanley. Stephen Roach, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
How do you describe the stakes in this meeting, in this relationship today?
Well, Tom, I can't put his finger on the issue. Washington, especially the Congress, is listing in a very dangerous protectionist direction, and the Bush administration cabinet wants to close that effort off at the pass. They want China to somehow come up with a magic that fixes things that seem to be ailing American workers. And the Chinese, from their point of view, say, look, hold on a second. Maybe a lot of these problems that your workers are feeling are due to some problems in your own economy, and why should we accept the position that you are trying to put us in as a scapegoat? And the Chinese view is that, yes, there's a huge bilateral trade deficit between the two nations, but in many respects that reflects the lack of savings that goes on in the United States and the fact that as a savings-short nation, we need to run lots of trade deficits with lots of our trading partners, and China is just part of that equation.
Stephen Roach, is this a healthy economic relationship these days? We see all the debt that China holds. I mean, $1 trillion globally, about a third of that American. We see the big bilateral trade deficit. We hear the arguments that you lay out from both sides right there. But on balance, is this a healthy relationship or is it a dangerous relationship?
Look, I think the relationship itself is a very complex relationship. But when you ask questions, Tom, about health, I'm worried about the long-term health of the U.S. economy if we don't save. I'm worried about the long-term health of the Chinese economy if they have too much of their national output focused solely on exports and investment at the cost of not providing support for their domestic private consumption. Both nations have longer-term considerations with respect to health, and the relationship between the two nations is very much an outgrowth of some of the problems that they face individually.
Kenneth Rogoff and Stephen Roach, play out some scenarios for us here that will put this in concrete terms that take it all the way down at the end of the domino line to how it affects ordinary Americans. If we get in trouble, let's say China gets in trouble, Kenneth Rogoff, there's the possibility people talk of a Chinese crash. What would be likely to bring this racing economy down a notch or more? And if that happens, what does the knock-on effect look like?
Well, the biggest vulnerability in China is really the political system. China's emerged. They have the people on the coast, about a third of the people, doing very well. But then the people in the interior, and this is an overstatement, but are really doing a lot worse. There are a couple hundred million people, perhaps even, who are effectively unemployed. A lot of people, you can go 100 kilometers from Beijing, living in grinding poverty. And you have this authoritarian political system holding it all down. But as capitalism grows, there's inevitably power spreading, there's inevitably political changes, and that is the fundamental weakness in the system. You can point at a lot of others. The banking system is, you know, from another century, very vulnerable. A lot of the state-owned enterprises, you know, still need to be reformed. There are lots of issues in the economy. They're trying to juggle a lot of things at once to keep this thing moving, and there could be an accident. Now, if China had a long-term problem, it'd be the worst thing for the United States. I think the rise of China has been fantastic for the United States overall. And a lot of what we see as our glory in the last 10 and 15 years, our huge productivity, our huge growth, has come in no small part from trading with Asia and all the benefits we get. But on the other hand, I think the reason that these cabinet secretaries are there, the reason that they're so concerned, is that there is this feeling that these benefits are not being shared equally. And we need to think about it. And I just say in passing that, you know, Secretary Paulson's pushing for opening up the financial sector in China. And I applaud most of what he's doing, but I find this a little tone deaf because, of course, Wall Street's making huge profits, and that's not really, you know, the sector where Congress is worried about.
And here we've got the former chairman of Goldman Sachs pushing hard on that front. Stephen Roach, help us along the scenario path and China's vulnerabilities. It can look so red hot, so rich, so successful on the export front these days. How do you see its specific vulnerabilities? And if a crash would come, and many people say a crash is inevitable at some point in China, what's likely to spark it? What would it look like? What about the knock-on effect in your view?
Well, Tom, I'm not in this hard landing camp. I mean, with respect to China, the China doomsday scenario has been around for as long as I've been going to China, and it hasn't happened, and I think the odds of it are low. I think that you know, the numbers speak pretty well for themselves on a published basis. You know, China's had 15 years of GDP growth of around 10%. The point that I would make is that the Chinese, as well as most macroeconomists, and I think Ken is sympathetic to this point as well, but he can speak for himself, know that the current growth model is nearing its limit. You now have two sectors, investment in plant and equipment and exports, that are over 80%, 80% of Chinese GDP. And the private consumption numbers in China last year fell to a record low of 38% of GDP. No economy can sustain a macro imbalance like that indefinitely. And the Chinese, to their credit, recognize that and are really attempting to move to more of a consumer-led model. That's going to take more time. But if they don't change the structure of the economy, the excesses of investment will build, and that will lead to capacity overhangs, which eventually is very deflationary for any economy, including China. And on the export side, it will result in intensified protectionist pressures coming out of Washington, which would be very worrisome to the sustainability of the Chinese growth model. So China needs to change, but by the way, so do we. This should not be viewed as a summit between Washington and Beijing, where America's marching into Beijing and telling China, here's a list of 12 things you have to do, and we're fine, thank you.
I can't see anybody quite looking at it that way yet, but still trying to feel this concretely. As you said, there's a lot to be done on the American side, more saving maybe above all. But to make it clear, if China's economy should falter, given how deeply entwined it is with the U.S. economy now, what would that look like? What would the effect for the U.S. be? Why does it matter, Stephen Rose, to the U.S. today?
Well, China's a very big trading partner with the United States, provides us with a lot of low-cost, increasingly high-quality imports. It's also an increasingly larger source of our export business as well. And, of course, China, at the margin, is helping us fund our savings shortfall by putting an inordinate amount of its now $1 trillion of foreign exchange reserves invested in treasuries and other types of dollar-based assets. So China has not only become part of our supply chain, but it's also become a critical piece of our financing chain. And we need the Chinese funding of our savings short economy if we are able to sustain our growth. And if there's an accident in China, if we impose some type of tariffs on China, many congressmen want to do, that funding may not be there, and that would have significant consequences for the value of the U.S. dollar and for interest rates in the United States.
A lot of these things are plain to an economist, but not necessarily to the rest of us. Kenneth Rogoff, if that ever went away, that Chinese sort of footing the bill for the big American debt, what would the consequences be for the U.S. economy, for Americans?
Well, I mean, if we didn't borrow at all from abroad, if we had to somehow tighten our belt, we've been borrowing about $800 billion a year, it would radically drive up interest rates on your mortgages, your cars, everything. As Stephen said, the dollar would tank and imports would start becoming a lot more expensive. So just that would be very painful. And it could lead to a financial crisis because we have a lot of overextended hedge funds, banks that have lots of complex bets nobody understands. But we know that if there's a big shift in interest rates and the exchange rate, some of them are going to go belly up. So a dramatic, sudden changing in this relationship, which I agree is not, you know, the likely scenario, but it's a risk, that would be very painful to us.
Joe's calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, Joe. You're on the air with Kenneth Rogoff and Stephen Roach.
Hi. In answer to, I guess, the program's question, who's driving the bus,
yeah.
This delegation from Washington in China demonstrates that the Chinese are driving the bus. And our delegates, our representatives over there, are not going to make any harsh demands on the Chinese. And they're going to tiptoe around all the issues, and they're going to come home empty-handed. And one of your guests cast this as U.S. protectionism, and that we have to change our policies. That's 180 degrees in the wrong direction. The Chinese are the protectionists. They have the 40% currency undervaluation, which favors their exports and keeps out our imports. They subsidize everything they produce. They steal our intellectual property. They have no labor standards. They have no environmental standards. Those are the things that have to change, not the U.S. Our market is wide open, and that's why we've got a $200 billion-plus deficit with China, which is growing.
Joe, we hear it loud and clear. Let me put it to Stephen Roach. Mr. Roach, there's the bill of complaint. How do you respond to it?
Well, Joe, I understand your concern. But I think you're painting a very one-sided story. There are a number of issues that China can be held accountable for on with respect to trading practices, and I'm particularly sensitive to the point that you're making on the protection of intellectual property. I think this is a big issue that the Chinese need to grapple with, and could certainly make some major strides in improving the way in which they handle this issue. But the good news is that China is now and has been for 5 years a member of the WTO, which is a rules-based system that we in the West endorse and are members of and can be used to adjudicate any disputes with the Chinese that are as egregious as you say. And if in fact, the issues are as serious as you are maintaining, then I would ask the U.S. trade officials, why haven't they brought China into the WTO to file a number of serious disputes?
Are you suggesting by that that the Chinese protectionism is not a factor, as Joe says, Stephen Roach, or that the U.S. officials just aren't being aggressive on it?
I think it's been exaggerated. I do think that there are a number of issues that should be negotiated on both sides, and the point that I was making with respect to U.S. economic policies is that this should not be viewed as a black and white issue where China has the problem and things are fine in America. There are issues on both sides of the of this debate that need to be addressed, both in Washington and in Beijing. And the point that I would put back to Joe is, look, if we were to close down trade with China today, eliminate that $200 billion deficit you just said, unless we save, the $200 billion would show up in the form of deficits with other trading partners. It would have to, Joe. And most likely, the $200 billion would show up with other countries who would sell us things for a higher price.
You mean it wouldn't reopen factories
quality.
In Ohio?
So that would be a tax on the American people.
What about the currency question here, Kenneth Rogoff? Joe says 40% the Chinese currency is out of whack here. That's bigger than I've heard anyone saying. Hank Paulson has likely asked them to move, but is it possible to calculate what it really ought to be fair, to be market-based, to be appropriate to the moment in trade?
Short answer is no, that making it flexible in the market will tell us. I want to pick up on this point about who is it partly our problem. I mean, we're going over there and saying, look, we're borrowing too much. We're running this big deficit. We're living beyond our means. You've got to help us. You've got to appreciate your currency. And of course, the Chinese turn around and say, well, wait a second. You're telling us you're borrowing too much. You have a problem. Why is it all our problem? And of course, they're right. I mean, it's complex that we could take actions that would lower the deficit, that would raise our savings too. I think the biggest problem in our relationships with China the last couple of years on the economic side is we go over there, we lecture them, we tell them what we want to do, but we don't offer anything back. We don't want them to pollute as much. Well, my goodness, we account for more of the world's pollution still than they do. So we need to treat them like the other great power that they are emerging as, and we're not going to get anything out of them if we don't offer something in return.
Now, this is Hank Paulson's position too, isn't it, that the U.S. has been too hectoring in recent years, that it needs to have a long-term strategic relationship? This is meeting number one in that process.
Well, wait a second. I mean, that just means he'll be patient for them to do what he wants them to do.
I see.
But it doesn't mean that we're delivering on our side. Are we doing something about our budget deficit? Are we doing something to raise saving?
We've been joined by Kenneth Rogoff. He was chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. He's professor of economics at Harvard and currently a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. Stephen Roach is with us. He's managing director and chief economist at Morgan Stanley. Kelly's calling from Panama City, Florida. Hi, Kelly. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom.
Yeah.
The question I have is, I'm in the Air Force, and so when I view this, I view it from a security perspective.
Okay.
And my belief is that by allowing China to hold so much of our debt and by us continuing to borrow, that weakens our national security position when it comes to wanting them to agree on other items that we're trying to deal with around the world.
I mean, our national security, though, is pretty tied up with our economy on its own, but you're saying it extends beyond the economy?
What I'm saying is the economy is probably our biggest national interest, and by allowing China to have such a hold over it, doesn't that weaken our national security?
Stephen Roach, what do you say to the Air Force man's question?
Well, I'm sensitive to what Kelly is saying. I think the real problem, though, is our lack of willingness to save as a nation, and therefore we have to borrow from lots of other countries around the world, and that is, I think, something that jeopardizes the long-term security and health of our nation. Now, whether or not the jeopardy becomes more acute because the Chinese are holding the debt as opposed to the Japanese holding the debt, that gets into a different aspect of the equation. But I think the fundamental issue that Kelly is raising is national security. How secure are we as a country without saving ourselves?
Kenneth Rogoff, we keep coming back to American savings here, even as Chinese policy gets a look over too. For listeners, what are we really talking about there? Is that primarily our federal deficit, or is it, you know, household budgets and the visa bill? What's the majority of that?
Right now, the larger part of it is the private sector, but it's close. It's about half and half if you look at the United States' overall borrowing. The government sector, you could change a lot just by raising taxes or lowering spending. Private sector is way trickier. We're spending a lot because a lot of people feel rich because of their houses. So the savings rate, I think, of ordinary people is probably going to come up relatively slowly.
So if we could change the federal deficit situation, a big impact and maybe easier to change, does that mean, going ahead with Kelly's kind of framing here, that the Bush administration deficits have diminished our national security?
Now, I wouldn't go that far. And by the way, I think the short answer to Kelly's question, I agree with what Steve said at a deeper level, but the short answer is if you owe enough to the bank, it's the bank's problem, not yours. I mean, the last thing on earth, China's holding over $1 trillion of reserves. The last thing on earth they want to see is a dollar collapse, which is going to cost them a lot of money. In fact, that's one of the reasons they have trouble diversifying. But I think that it's much easier to do something with the federal government in order to reduce our current account deficit. But, I mean, the security issue, there's a real security issue with China. I think it's been a good one so far. Mm-hmm. I think the fact China is now our counterpart in the global system, as opposed to Russia, they're a lot more constructive. They want to conquer our markets, but they're not looking to conquer us. It's a lot easier situation to deal with.
So some advantages at being joined at the hip here, even as there are problems too. Sam's calling from Wallingford, Connecticut. Hi, Sam. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. Now, a lot of people are talking about cutting off China or severely decreasing our imports for them because of some of their sort of deplorable labor policies.
Right.
But I wonder if doing this will really kind of maybe adversely affect many of the millions of people who are working for these companies and end up doing a lot more bad than good. And maybe is it a possibility that we could instead maybe just demand in some other way a lot more from China in the way of their labor policies instead of, you know, potentially cutting them off and, you know, producing a lot of adverse effects for millions of laborers.
Well, let us look at that side of it for a minute. Stephen Roach, look into China for a second. If the U.S. is trying to pressure China to change some of its trade policies, its currency, maybe even its labor policies, what do the Chinese leaders, when they look into their own country domestically, do they see room to do that without hurting the overall economy? You know, can we lay down these demands to help Americans without hurting Chinese labor?
Tom, I spend a lot of my time in China. I've been to China 6 times this year, mm-hmm. and in many of these trips, I have the opportunity to see inside of Chinese factories and see firsthand the conditions of Chinese workers. There are obviously some cases of extremes in China where the conditions for workers are not terrific. But in the factories that I've seen, and I've seen countless numbers of them, the conditions are immeasurably better than the life that these workers had led in their rural countryside. Yes, they live sometimes in dormitory-style rooms with 5, 6, 7, 8 workers per room. in bunk beds that you would see in a university or a college in the United States. But their lot is materially better than it used to. And the Chinese are very sensitive to raising the standards of rural workers. In their newly enacted five-year plan, a lot of emphasis is placed on expanding the medical care and the income subsidies for rural workers, the education support. If there's one thing that the leaders of China really are stressing right now, and this is an issue that Ken raised at the outset, it's this potential of a divergence between the poor rural parts of China and the wealthier coastal parts. I think the images we have of these abusive, unfair labor practices are exaggerated. They do need to be updated. I'm not saying that the average Chinese worker lives a life of unbridled prosperity, but it is not nearly the abusive type of picture that often gets painted in the West.
And yet, Kenneth Rogoff, today in China, the vice premier there, Wu Yi, describing China as still an underdeveloped country, looking at how low the sort of average national income is. What about China's room to maneuver with its own social stability domestically when it's under pressure from the U.S.? Okay, there's Washington saying we want this and that. What are the counter pressures from inside this enormous country?
Well, Steve hit the nail on the head that when we talk about labor practices, we got to look at the life these people are coming from. And the fact is that everyone's trying to get out of the rural area in China where they're underemployed or unemployed and live in horrible poverty. And they're trying to get into the city, trying to work in these factories. China is bringing on the order of 10 to 12 million people a year into the cities, building new cities to try to take some of the pressure off. That is the big challenge. They've got to keep that machine going. If that slows down, if they have a couple of years where that's not train is not moving, there's going to be huge political problems. And so that's the thing they want. They don't want to have the economy slow down.
So when Paulson says, come on, we need some relief on the currency, doesn't that suggest a slowdown might come in its wake if they responded by bumping up the yuan, the renminbi? And so are they looking at a kind of cause and effect? If they say yes to Washington, they have political problems at home?
I believe that if they say yes and allow a bit more currency flexibility, the effect is going to be very, very small and mostly good. There are some risks, but by and large, Japan had their currency appreciate a ton since 1970, like 300% or something like that. And they still, you know, managed to grow, managed to run surpluses. I think it's way overrated, the risk, but it's reached the symbolism that both sides are stuck. If China would do this, if they would give Paulson this, he'd come home a hero. They'd buy 2 years of peace. I think it would be a great idea, but I don't know if we're going to see it.
Stephen Roach, yes, Japan had some great years, but then they've just had a decade of real slow economic growth. Would China risk that if it responds to Paulson in Washington here? And could it, I don't know, survive a decade of slow growth like Japan has seen given its political volatility?
No, Tom, there's a huge difference between Japan and China. Japan's a wealthy, developed nation. And China is far from that. And I completely agree with Ken that in China, social stability is everything. And if they were to take actions that might slow the economy's growth down sharply, such that unemployment would rise, that would be an unacceptable outcome for the Chinese leadership. So Don't count on the Chinese to take risk in that regard with moving aggressively on the currency. That does not mean they should not move on other issues. But I think they have a real stop point in terms of how far. I agree with Ken. They could do a little bit, and that might help a lot. But beyond that, the answer is absolutely no.
Sounds like a hard sell here, even for the famously persuasive Hank Paulson. Mark's calling from Washington. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I love your program and love your discussion, but I'm repeatedly annoyed at the fact I hear about $200 billion in deficit over and over again, but nobody ever seems to mention the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars in U.S. revenues and profits. I mean, when you're getting $2 sneakers or $2 jeans and selling them on our store shelves for $65, that profit and that money is staying here in the United States. Why is it we never discuss the positive end of the deficit?
Kenneth Rogoff, what do you say to Mark's observation?
Well, of course, he's absolutely right. I mean, what I said earlier on, the thing that's fueled the United States economy, that's made us look so good, has been this growth in technology, the cheap imports from China, the combination of the two. But there is this tension that it's made things churn very fast, people losing their jobs in states like South Carolina. And, you know, the sort of the joke is that what do you tell these people, that their unemployment checks can go farther at Walmart thanks to China?
Yeah, thanks a lot for that. Let me go to Peter in Attleboro, Massachusetts. Peter, you're on the air.
Yeah, I was listening earlier before this program came on, and someone had mentioned about our trade imbalance with China was due to the fact that a lot of our jobs are being transferred to China for cheap labor, mm-hmm. and as a result, you know, we have this situation. Well, if that is the case, and that is so obvious to many people, why is these elected officials and these CEOs of these corporations continuing to do the same thing that is causing the trade imbalance? This is not China's fault. We put ourselves in this boat, and now we're going to China telling China to fix it for us. I don't understand that. I don't understand that logic. I mean, how can we continue to shoot our foot shoot ourselves in the foot with our short-sighted policies as far as chasing the cheap labor wherever it's at, and then turn around and say, well, guys, you got to help us fix this, you know, help us save our jobs.
Right. We hear that. Of course, policies are part of what determines what labor is paid and where it's most advantageous. But Stephen Roach, you hear Peter there saying, is it China's fault if American companies want to move manufacturing to China?
All I can say is thank you, Peter. I was waiting for someone to say that, and if Peter hadn't said it, I would have said it myself. Let me just give you some numbers to really underscore that. In the last 10 years, Peter, China's exports have moved up by 600% from where they were 10 years ago. But did you know that over 60% of that growth is traceable to exports of Chinese subsidiaries of big multinational companies from all over the world, Japan, Europe, and yes, even the United States? Who is China? Is China really their own companies that are taking our jobs from us, or is it us that are sending jobs and resources to this low-cost economy in an effort to become more efficient in a very competitive global economy?
Kenneth Rogoff, here we've got this delegation, including Ben Bernanke. There's been some controversy around that, whether or not the chairman of the Federal Reserve should be part of a delegation like this when inflation and deflation and all the rest are on the table. They're going to be sitting down with the president and premier of China. What do you think of Bernanke being there, and how do inflation and deflation hover around these conversations?
Well, I think by and large, Bernanke's there simply to elevate the stature of the delegation, to lend Paulson support. I mean, Paulson has a lot staked on this. If he comes back empty-handed, if nothing's happened after 6 months, his ability to persuade Congress about anything's going to be very weak. And I think he's basically called in all his chips, told people this is really important, which it sure is. And I think Bernanke's gone along in that spirit to try to help out. By and large, I don't think, you know, the U.S. Federal Reserve's like a central player here in what's going on.
But Bernanke's there. And how do you interpret, Kenneth Rogoff, you know, when they're sitting there with Wu Yi or the Chinese premier and president, what's the basic power dynamic as they look at each other? What do they know about their two countries? What's kind of the fundamental thing on the table here?
Well, I expect that the dialogue when the microphones aren't on is actually quite candid. You know, that I found the Chinese leadership, especially the senior leadership, to just speak very, very forthrightly, candidly, and I must say very intelligently about what the problems are. So I'm sure that the dialogue is very good and very constructive, but I guess the big question is, you know, what's the takeaway? Certainly learning each other's good. That's Madam Wu has emphasized that. But I think it's going to be very tough on Paulson if he doesn't have something to show after 6 months.
Stephen Roach, the heart of what's on the table in these conversations, intelligent and forthright as they may be, what's the heart of it? What's being chewed over here?
I think the heart of it is that this is a very important relationship. And by the U.S. sending such a high-level delegation to Beijing, they do need to come back with what Washington would call deliverables. If they come back empty-handed, then I think it could be rather difficult politically in Washington with a newly controlled Democratic Congress in early 2007. The real pressure on the U.S.-China relationship is coming from the Congress. And I think what's interesting about these meetings this week in Beijing is that the last time I checked, no one from the Congress is on that delegation. In fact, you have a Republican administration that's pretty much out of power that is negotiating with the Chinese right now.
Not a Democrat on there, but of course all eyes on the delegation. I want to thank you both for a great conversation. Stephen Roach, Managing Director, Chief Economist at Morgan Stanley, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
And Kenneth Rogoff, Professor of Economics at Harvard. Kenneth Rogoff, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.